Accession number 18498, real one.
John Howe, real one. Where were you born, please?
I was born in a small port in South Africa called East London.
Which year was this?
This was in 1930.
Can you tell me a bit about your family background, please? What your father did for a living?
Yes, well, my father was English. He was born in South Africa. His parents emigrated. And he was a printer in the family printing work, F. Howe and Co.
Which part of England did he come from?
I don't know. My mother was an Aberdonian, and she emigrated with her family in the 20s and met my father, and they were married. And we lived in East London. They lived in East London. And they both died in East London at a fairly old age.
Did you have your schooling in South Africa?
Yes. My main school was in Grahamstown, which is about 120 miles from East London, called St. Andrew's College. It's one of the, what they call private, but what we would call public schools here.
And can you remember anything about the Second World War and how it affected you personally?
Yes, I can. I remember the coastal artillery guns being put up on the Signal Hill behind the harbour in East London. And I remember guards. And I remember the aeroplanes flying. And one of the most remarkable memories, there was later on in the 40s when I left home to go to boarding school. We had evacuees from the UK and some from North Africa where their parents had been based. And the stories that some of them told us of the Blitz were absolutely horrifying. I remember one, we used to have the practice air raid warnings every Wednesday just to check the systems. As I understand it, I was only 9 or 10 at the time. And the first time these young chaps heard the sirens, they got a fright. And I'll never forget that. And we used to spend most of our holidays on the beach and surfing. And the beach was basically next to the port, the harbour. And we used to chat to chaps who came in. And then the various families would adopt an RAF guy who was out there training. And I remember several of them. Names I've forgotten now, obviously. But I remember them.
What was the attitude among South African civilians towards the war?
Depends what your basic nationality was. If you were British, you were wholeheartedly in support of England, basically, and the Commonwealth. If you were an Afrikaner, you never forgot the Boer War. And you hated the English and you backed the Germans.
So it was as clear-cut as that, was it?
The radical Afrikaner, yeah. I mean, I remember there was a chap who used to wrestle for the South African Olympic team called Roby Leybrand, who went over to the 1936 Olympics in Berlin. And he became just infatuated with the whole idea of the black shirts and the Nazis. And he stayed behind. And halfway during the war, by which time he'd been trained as an infiltrator and how to use high explosives. He was landed off the coast of Southwest Africa from a submarine, came down to South Africa, and was involved in blowing up railways and that sort of thing. He was caught, and for treason was sentenced to death. And Jan Smuts, excuse me, commuted the death sentence to life imprisonment. And the interesting thing was that when the nationalist government, who were Afrikaners, came into power in 1948, I think it was within months, Roby Lebrandt was released and given a free pardon. That shows you the difference.
Did you have Afrikaners in your area, in East London and Grahamstown?
Yes, but not many. Not many.
Did they express their political opinions regarding the war?
No. No, because they were so outnumbered. places like Natal, where we were, East London and the border region, Cape, predominantly non-Afrikaner. The Transvaal, the Orange Free State, predominantly Afrikaner.
I've interviewed a lot of British servicemen who stopped off on the way to the Middle East and Far East.
Yes.
At Cape Town, Durban.
Yes. And the White Lady.
They described the White Lady, and they described the hospitality which they were given by South African civilians. Did you come across that from the other side?
No, but the Afrikaner, from the hospitality point of view, would always, if you needed hospitality in passing, as it were, he would provide it. And then if at a later date he saw you, he'd cut you dead. But it is their tradition, or was their tradition, to provide hospitality.
What about the black South Africans? Did they have an attitude towards the war?
Not to my knowledge. You see, it was a... I look back on it and I can hardly believe it. I really didn't know anything about blacks. I mean, we had servants. My nanny was black. And I thought she was wonderful. But my first recollection of blacks in uniform was seeing, I suppose there must have been a company, about 100 of them, marching along. Their kit was absolutely immaculate. Their boots were like mirrors, like glass. And the steel heel and toe caps thumping into the road, absolutely in unison. And they sang as they marched. And it was fantastic. An African or Zulu song, I can't remember. But if you hear the Africans sing, it's very stirring, and that is what I remember.
Where do you think they were going?
I've no idea. No idea.
Did the war have any effect on living standards for you or South Africa?
World War II? Hardly. I would say by comparison, none. We had rationing. We had petrol rationed, obviously. I think flour was rationed. But I can't remember any hardship. We got what, I suppose, if you were wanting to buy motor cars and things like that, well, you couldn't because they weren't being produced. But it had very little effect on my generation from that point of view. But I mean, my memories of it, I remember I'd always wanted to fly. I never wanted to drive a fire engine or a bus or a railway engine. I'd always wanted to fly since I can remember. And I remember being, I used to read Biggles and listen to the news and read about the Battle of Britain and watch the aeroplanes fly, because there was a flying school near Grahamstown too. And I remember when we were about 12 or 13, a couple of us were discussing about whether we should run away and join the Air Force and go and fight and lie about our age. Yeah.
Were there any celebrations that you observed at the end of the Second World War?
Yes. There was lots of it, but you see, I was, well, that was 45, I was 15 and I was at school, at boarding school. So although you heard about it, we didn't actually participate.
How did you come to be in the Air Force yourself?
Well, as I said, I always wanted to fly. And when I left school at the end of 47, I applied to join a military college as a cadet, because there was no Air Force college then. And the only way you could get into the Air Force with a permanent commission was to go through the military cadetship at the military college, which is what I did. And we went there, I think 36 of us graduated after 2 years. That was a pretty tough course, I tell you. Half went to the army, a variety of units, tanks, infantry, artillery, coastal artillery, engineers, and half went to learn to fly.
Where is the college?
Just outside Pretoria. Excuse me, a place called Voortrekkerhoogte, the Voortrekker Heights. And it's still there. The buildings are still there. But I did my flying training at Central Flying School, which was more to the east of the Transvaal, at the end of the, what they call the Witwatersrand, the mining strip. And I got my wings in December 50.
How did you take to flying when it came to it?
Oh, I loved it. I just loved it. I remember on the first time I ever flew was with a friend in the Tiger Moth, and we did a loop and we went a bit slow around the top of the loop, and I suppose my backside came off the seat by about a millimetre, and I felt I'd dropped 100 feet, and I just grabbed onto those spars in front of the cockpit and hung on, and I was frightened. But after I started flying properly, I used to loosen my straps. This is in a Tiger Moth, on a lovely summer's day. I'd climb up to about 5,000 feet, do my exercises that I had to do. And then I'd just turn upside down and hang in my straps and just feel the wind blowing past my face. I just loved it.
Was the Transvaal a good place to learn how to fly?
The weather factor was very good. Very good. And I suppose the only drawback was it's about 5,000 feet high, so above sea level. So your engines weren't quite as powerful as they would have been at sea level. But the weather was good, generally. Summer afternoons at about 4 o'clock you'd see the thunderstorms building up, but otherwise it was fairly dry and clear.
What was the next step after this?
Well, I got my wings, or we all got our wings, and we got 200 hours. And we then did a Spitfire conversion at Central Flying School of about 10 hours, I think. And then we went down to the operational conversion unit at a place called Langebaanweg, because by then the Korean War was on. and we were all going to Korea. And our OCU was on Spitfires. And we did air-to-air, air-to-ground, bomber escort, bomber interception, dive bombing. And I think the course was about 30 hours. And then we got basically a long weekend, I think, and off to Korea.
So this was on Spitfires that you were training?
Yes.
What did you think to the Spitfire to fly?
Oh, I loved it. I loved it. We had Spitfire 5s and 9s. We had elliptical and clip wing. And we had the two different Rolls-Royce engines. One, I think, was the Rolls-Royce 66, which cut with negative G, and the other one didn't. So every now and again you got a fright. Yeah, doing the slow roll, you might think you had a Merlin 70, I think it was. And it wasn't, it was a Merlin 60, so the engine would cut as you got upside down. But you got used to that.
Was it mostly British origin or Dutch origin or both in who were training with you at the time?
Both. Both. I had, we had some really super Afrikaans chaps on the course. Really super.
Was the comradeship between the two in the oh, yes. South African Air Force?
Oh, yes. Very, very strong. But they weren't tied to that sort of Afrikaner background. I don't think they were... I mean, for instance, during the war, they used to assault people in uniform. They really did give people a hard time in uniform, and particularly if they were British, these Afrikaners. But they weren't all like that, obviously.
But you said the Afrikaans brother officers in the South African Air Force were different.
Yes.
In what sense were they different?
Well, they supported the war, they supported the Commonwealth. They weren't anti-British.
Which squadron did you go into?
I went into 2 Squadron, number 2 Squadron SAF. Our emblem was the cheetah.
And what were they flying?
Mustangs, 51D.
And what did you think of the Mustang as compared with the Spitfire?
I loved the Mustang. I guess I just loved all aeroplanes I flew. But the Mustang was very, very good for the job. It had a tremendous range. We could carry basically the weight of the aircraft in munitions and fuel. It wasn't as agile. It wasn't as well balanced on the controls to the feel as a Spitfire. But it was very pleasant to fly. It was strong, and as I said, had tremendous range and endurance. The one big drawback was that it seemed by comparing the sizes of the aeroplanes, the Spitfire rudder was bigger than the Mustang rudder. Consequently, you had better control on your takeoff run and on your landing run, but on takeoff particularly, because you had to be careful on the Mustang, because if you got the nose up, if you got the tail up too soon, the torque and the gyroscopic effect would give you a tremendous swing. And I had one of my best friend, Kills, he just got the tail up on his first combat mission. I strapped him in, actually. I knew he was concerned. And he took off and he got the tail up too soon, and he basically did a 90-degree swing. Two 500-pounders, 620-pound warhead rockets, ammunition full, fuel full, and he just blew. And he scythed through a line of aeroplanes, and they all caught alight.
Was that in South Africa?
No, that was in Korea. Because basically we'd never flown the Mustang until we got to Korea. And then I think we did something like five trips to become accustomed, and then we started flying combat.
Can you tell me about the journey from South Africa to Korea, please?
Yes. We flew South African Airways, and we went to Nairobi. Yes, I think we were in an aeroplane called a Constellation. Four engine, piston engine, and three fins. And we landed at Nairobi and we spent the night. And then the following day we went to Khartoum and refueled, and then we went to Cairo where we spent the night. And then we changed to BOAC and we flew Cairo, Basra, Delhi, Calcutta, Rangoon, Bangkok, Hong Kong, and a big American base between Hong Kong and Japan. Name I forget.
Guam? Okinawa?
Okinawa, I think. And then we flew into Haneda Airport in Tokyo, and we stayed the night in, we were staying sort of nights in these various places, and then we arrived in Japan where we were given a briefing, and then flew from Tachikawa out to our base, which was K-10, which was at a little place called Maesan, a few miles east of Pusan, which was the capital of South Korea.
It seems from your logbook that you started flying in Korea on the 1st of June,
yes.
1951.
Yes.
Whereabouts were, did you say you were based in
Korea? A place called K-10. All the bases had code numbers. K-10 was at a little, next to a little fishing village in those days, I suppose, called Maesan, M-A-S-A-N, which was, I suppose, 10 miles or so on the coast east of Pusan.
What kind of facilities did you have at this base, if any?
There was a single runway, which was made of PSP. The southern end just dropped straight into the sea. The north end, you took over across paddy fields, and there was a mountain about, I suppose, about 1,000, 1,200 feet within a couple of miles of the end of the runway. Fortunately, it had a saddle in it, so you could creep through there if the cloud was across the top of the mountains. That was the runway. The air traffic control was pretty good. We lived in huts. The South African squadron was in huts, operationally, huts out. Stores were in huts. Our South African squadron bar and club was in a little hut. It was called Rorke's Drift. The wing club for the officers was quite big, but all made of wood. I wasn't there in the winter, so I don't know about the central heating, but we didn't have anything cool, so it was very hot. And God, the smell of a place. Because in those days, the agriculture manure was animal and human. And I remember we flew from Japan to Korea for the first time in a Dakota DC-3. And I could smell Korea at 2,000 feet. We eventually got used to it, but it was something that was not very pleasant to start with.
And what kind of operations did the squadron start to carry out once you arrived?
Well, we were doing recce, main supply route. Basically, the aim was to isolate the battlefield. And above the what we call the bomb line, which is a line drawn on the map a mile or so north of the United Nations forces. So there was a gap between them and where you would start attacking unbriefed, as it were. Anything we saw moving, we attacked. Anything. And so our missions would be recces of the main supply routes. We'd have bridges. We'd attack dockyards, marshalling yards, factories, airfields, tanks, infantry, roads, mountain passes. I.e., if you could thump a few 500 pounders into the side of a mountain pass and you'd close it. But our sorties generally, we did flak busting, we did long range escort. But the main role was low level recce and attacking anything that moved. You would be given, for instance, you'd be given your main target for the mission would be go and attack such and such a bridge. And then when you've done that with your 500 pounders, say, you'd then be given a route to recce. And anything you saw, you then attack with rockets and guns. Or you would have a close support mission where you would go straight and report into the local controllers who were with the infantry or the artillery, and they would then send you to a forward air controller or to a controller in a Harvard, and they would direct your strike onto the enemy forces, and we'd attack infantry, tanks, artillery, bunker complexes. I remember on the bunkers, you knew they were in there. So we started mixing the weapons. So the first two guys would have delayed fuse, delayed action, 500 pounders. Say it's an 8 to 10 second delay. And they'd thump these 500 pounders into the bunkers. And they'd go off and blow the tops off. And then you'd